Item A, death during active membership, a non-service connected disability and optional settlement two information. Tim.
Okay, good morning. This is
purely informational, no action is required. At the February 13th meeting, the board expressed interest in discussing this benefit, historical data, and potentially providing more direction to staff on the benefit moving forward. You've been provided with a couple of documents that were provided earlier this year, correspondence from legal counsel regarding the benefit and the history of it. On the second page of the memorandum, we'll note there's a chart that has the activity that has taken place over the 10 plus years as far as active deaths being processed. You'll note that it's a very low number, anywhere, well, zero in a couple of years and three in a couple of years. Other than that, most of the years had one active death process.
Tim, how many do you have on file?
As far as forms, I'll give you an estimate that we're probably 25% of our members have them on file. A high number of them, you know, they go on file, they end their employment. The day their employment ends, their membership, that benefit drops from membership, or they retire, the benefit drops from membership. From the deaths that come in on active and deferred deaths, it's probably about one in five have an active death form on file or had one that we will act on. So it's a very low number, but they seem to go in, you know, kind of spurts at time. And in a lot of cases, you know, the reasons that they've been applied for, they go through this process, it's cancer related and it's a long-term illness, or recently we've had heart issues.
So Tim, that's, to me, it sounds like an incredibly low percentage, 25. I mean, it's part of our new hire packs, so at Central Sand. Do we do any sort of outreach? Do we ever put it in like a newsletter or year-end statements encouraging people to have this form on file?
Yeah, I mean, it's noted in the memo. You know, we put it in, it's in the benefit handbooks.
Right.
So, again, generally only someone goes to the benefit handbooks when, you know, when they're looking for something, a specific rule or maybe an exception. It's in our website postings. We also do it in all of our retirement benefit presentations. We at least have, as the board saw a couple of meetings ago where we went through the pre-retirement workshop, we even talk about it to that group as they're approaching retirement, that if they don't have the form on file, to put it on file. And I believe it has also been in one of our newsletters in over the last couple of years.
Could it be a consideration, you know, I don't like to get into day-to-day ops or anything, but just maybe staff can discuss if it would be prudent to include that in the year-end. We send a year-end statement to people. It says, you know, this is your contributions to date. And maybe I'm just not remembering my most recent statement, does it say if we have an active death form on file and who the beneficiary is?
I don't think so.
The beneficiary is included, but the active death form information is not maintained in the CPAS system.
Again, I'll leave it to staff, but that could be something that would, if it was included, might have members, you know, actively putting that on that form on file, you know, since it is a benefit of theirs.
That could help.
Rusty?
Kind of said that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. So of people who, of the 25% that had an active death form on file that passed away while working for their employer, how many of those did we reject, if any? Or pretty much were all of them approved if there was, you know, again, there's medical, I read the standards that we have. So I'm just curious, did we reject any? And this sort of goes to my question last time where we met with, is there ever an instance where if someone has this on file that someone would not be able to argue, yes, you were disabled because you died? And again, I'm recognizing they would have been disabled for some short period of time ahead of time. So bottom line question is, have we rejected any of those 25% who had applications?
To my knowledge, we have not rejected any, because the ones that do come to the board generally have fulfilled all of the requirements.
Right.
And were timely, you know, timely, the information was provided and so forth. So to my knowledge, especially since I've been here, I have not seen any rejected by the board.
Okay. I would agree with Tim. I don't think the board has ever denied a non-service-connected disability on an active death form.
Well, and most of them, I'm assuming someone, I mean, we had a very unique case that we saw the circumstances which brought this forward where someone was found dead, they were actively working. In most instances, and again, I'm surprised at how few we have here, which is very interesting to me. Have most of those generally been employees who have gone off on disability? They're still employed, but they've taken time off because of, like you said, cancer or an illness, and then they've passed away while in disability? Or have we had very many like this one where someone just dies sort of out of the blue?
I mean, if I'm thinking back, you know, to the last five or so that have gone before the board, two of them were active employees that passed away, you know, on a heart-related issue.
Right.
And they were, you know, still employed, whether they were actively at work or not.
No, well, and to me, it's not so much the act of being at work, but whether or not they were being treated, they were off on a disability that we already, sort of the same determination we use when someone comes to us and requests a disability retirement. And so, as I look through this, I mean, to me, our policies make sense. Mm-hmm. We have good policies. We require certain findings to be made. And then I guess, to me, it's just sort of, what are those findings? And then that becomes the issue of the facts, not necessarily of the law.
Yeah, I mean, in 2018, I believe it was three cancer cases, and the individuals went off shortly before, they went off work shortly before passing away.
Right, that's what I would anticipate, that's why we created this disability form. But anyway, okay, no, so this is all very helpful.
I might comment. What really bothered me on our discussion was that the board was put in a world where it was asked to make a judgment on whether somebody lived a nanosecond or not. Mm-hmm. I just, there's no way in the world we can, any real way, do that. I would react on that, either that everybody is deemed to have become disabled, who otherwise meets our criteria, or they don't. Those are the two options. Either they are in a disability category before dying, or they're not. If they're not, because they don't have the form or they don't meet other requirements that we impose, they're treated, they get a death benefit, but the death benefit is not the disability income. It is the normal death benefit. Putting that clause in the middle, and I found by that, thank you for the package, that was very helpful in looking at some of Harvey's letters earlier on this. I just find that a very, I guess, uncomfortable probably isn't the right term, not the kind of thing I would ask a board to do.
I mean, I would get what you're saying. It's in the case that you're referring to, that's a challenge, and then you get to the incapacitation question, and what is the definition? Is it seconds, minutes? an hour.
All of which you're guessing because in the case just went through, no one was there.
We didn't have sufficient evidence, and I think that's how most of us felt. You know, had it been the employee who over the weekend started feeling really sick and then couldn't come into work the next day, there you at least have evidence. You have a witness. You have someone saying he was clearly disabled. He couldn't work. And I think that's where I was most troubled, sort of like you, of we're just speculating in that case entirely. And it sounds like we don't typically have those, although the case of one of your employees was very similar. We just weren't made apprised of those facts. And so I would have probably been equally troubled with that one, too, and recognizing, you know, heart attacks come on quickly. So
it's the unknown.
It is. No.
And I realize that, and we do go through that with our medical advisor, and we try to, you know, extrapolate as much information from them on that.
No, I know. And yes. We could argue all day about this. And I don't want to start that whole. I think it's important and that we have a good understanding of what some of us are going to feel more comfortable with than others. And so are you suggesting, John, that we should have language inserted, or is there, that modified that would?
Either that they are deemed to have qualified for disability if they meet all the other tests preceding death, and that's automatic, or that they are not deemed to become disabled, and hence it's not a disability benefit, it's a death benefit that we have for the, as we just heard, 80%, 75 to 80%, who don't have a foreman, for example.
Yeah, and I would not suggest we open that up as a death benefit. It would be a very expensive death benefit.
I'm in agreement with that.
And
I would rather make it I'd rather make it a death benefit, the standard death benefit that we have.
Right, saying unless you can establish that you had a disability and there's more than you were found dead, that there was an ongoing...
More than dead?
Yeah, but essentially that's what it is. I mean, no, but again, that's what we were sort of left with. You were dead, so you were disabled, and that was what was troubling. Because, yes, all of us will be disabled when we're dead. We can no longer perform our job, and I think... For it to be a disability benefit, what I think John is saying is you need to have some evidence that there was true disability, prior to just, rather than just dropping dead. Otherwise, then that's a death benefit. So
I'm trying to understand here, sorry. The disability benefit is being able to, as a survivor, opt for option 2 or 4. Is that right? My spouse had died while active, so my spouse leaves me with that option to go for 2 or 4. Mm-hmm. In that case, is there any other benefit than that?
In that case,
If my spouse dies in active duty for whatever reason, I'm the survivor. What are my benefits from this form on file? Am I able then to come in and say, okay, I'd like to claim my benefit? And you have a choice between option 2 and option 4. Is that right?
Yeah, 4 is for multiple benefits.
Right. Right. But I have a choice between the two.
The survivor does not have an option. The option is the members.
So the member declares that.
Okay. The member makes that election.
Okay.
On the form.
All right, that's
form.
A good point. So, but then the member or my spouse could make that decision before by filing out, putting this on file. Okay, and then when that the spouse passes away, I come in as a survivor and claim that benefit, whatever he, and hopefully I'd have knowledge too, agree to. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, is there any other benefit than that? Than option 2 or 4, whatever?
Well, there's no...
Just option 2.
Not really.
Well, there's no form, right? That's...
If there's no form,
whatever
it is.
There's no form,
right.
then you get the death benefit.
Okay.
Yeah, and then the death benefit.
Now, do I need this form to declare in the future if I were to die before retiring that I want my spouse to have option 2 or if I choose option, could I choose option 2, 3, or 4 before retiring, in other words, right now, could I do that? So if I were later to die before I retired, that then would go into effect.
The form allows that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what the form
is. Is this the only form I can use?
No.
For a disability benefit, the answer is yes. This is the only form.
That's my hang-up, disability. The disability is not being able to file the form because I died before retiring. Is that right? Or what am I?
Uh-huh. Well, it has to be on file. It's
well,
been
you
filed
it.
With the board.
Okay, and I'm trying to understand this form. Why couldn't we have another form that's not related to disability? Just whether if I get shot tomorrow, okay? Because I have on file that I was going to retire with option 2, 3, or 4, if I get shot tomorrow, then my spouse can exercise that, those options.
Call it the guns.
This isn't the only form that they have. I mean, we have the standard disability application.
Okay, and in that, that's in the application for retirement, and I can't file that until I'm actually planning to retire.
No,
I can't file that any sooner than when I plan to retire, right?
Yeah.
I couldn't file.
The benefit actually happens for someone that, you know, a tier 3 member that has 10 years, you know, the 10 years of service. They would receive the disability benefit for tier 3 non-service connected to 40% of their final average salary. And their calculated retirement benefit, first, they may not be eligible to retire, so then the death benefit would apply. The other side, if they were eligible to retire, the non-service connected disability benefit is greater. It's paying 40% rather than a lower percentage. For another individual that, say, is a long-term member and is retirement eligible, if they pass away, the benefit is for the surviving spouse is the option 2, 100% continuance. But that has the same value as the unmodified option, which would have paid 100% to the member, and if he passed away, 60% to the surviving spouse.
So in this last case, do I need this form on file?
No,
okay, that's what I'm trying to understand.
Well, in the last case, it actually provided a slightly better benefit to the individual than just using his service retirement, but he was eligible to retire.
All right, that's helpful to know.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it's kind of this roadmap you go down.
Could that explain why the other 75% don't have this form on file? Because they're retirement eligible.
Well, some of them, some of them don't have the 10 years of service, and they go, I don't have it yet, so they don't fill it out. I'm not going to be here 10 years, and you know, it's 20 years later, and they're still here. Right. They have multiple reasons.
So on both sides of the spectrum, either they're too young as employee, or they're old enough where they don't really need to exercise this. They have another alternative.
They just don't understand it, or it was never presented to them in a fashion that they had.
And I would agree with what Will said. I mean, when we do the pre-retirement workshops, you know, you say in the room, maybe half of the people have the form on file and half don't. And the half even that have the form on file, what's the benefit? I mean, that's a very common question that comes up from them. Or why do I need this? What does it do for me? I was just told to do it.
Gotcha.
You know, and then as you explain it to them, that if they're really making what you were talking about, an option, a pre-death, pre-retirement option 2 election if they had a lot of service already and it was greater than the percentage. So, but for tier 3, it's 10 years. For tier 1 and safety, it's 5. So it's a shorter period.
And it's non-service, ain't it?
Correct.
It's non-service unless you can claim it's job-related. So,
yeah, services.
A person goes out on a non-service disability prior to dying, he's going to die, and his spouse still gets the beneficiary amount, if it's 60% or whatever, he chooses for the spouse.
If this is they applied for a non-service connected disability, right, or they were processed through.
Right. But if I die, it's a non-service connected disability. So he's getting the disability either way. He's either dying while he's still working, or he's going to put in for a non-service disability because he can't do any gainful employment anymore.
Right. And so, if you get to, say, someone comes in to file for a non-service-connected disability, and again, we'll talk Tier 3 because, I mean, that's right. Our large population. If their service retirement benefit is equal or greater than 40%, there's really no reason to go through
the non-service sure.
process, you know, the time, the stress, and it doesn't get you, right. really buy you right. anything. Mm-hmm. And you can make the option to election Give at it. Retirement.
Right.
I wanted to make the yeah. point that this form, this really has to be a member election. They have to think and decide whether they want to do this. We have had some situations where this benefit ended up being less than others available if this election hadn't been made. And I also wanted to address some of the comments by John about creating or making this a death benefit. We're really only allowed to administer the benefits that are in the 37 Act. So this isn't a death benefit. This is a non-service connected disability benefit. And under the law, only the board can make a determination to grant a disability benefit. So it can't be converted into an automatic type benefit. It has to go to the board for a decision. And Candace made excellent points about the board has to be satisfied that there's sufficient evidence. It is the applicant's or the recipient's burden of proof to show that they were disabled. The process that we go through is you have an external medical advisor that looks at the evidence and provides you with a summary and a recommendation. We do have the disability hearing policy attached to our memo here. You will see that generally in situations where the medical advisor isn't able to recommend granting the benefit or the board is unable to grant, the applicant then has the opportunity to take the disability through a hearing process and then come back to the board with a hearing officer recommendation, and that process allows the applicant in an active death situation, it would be their survivor, their beneficiary, an opportunity to present evidence and have an objective administrative law judge look at everything and make a finding of fact and a recommendation for the board. So that certainly is a process that can be utilized if there isn't enough evidence for a majority of the board members to grant a disability. But we can't really circumvent this process of having active death disability determinations go to the board.
Erin, that is our process now.
Yes.
So what you're informing us is that we really can't change it? We really can't change what we do now?
You can't change the fact that only the board can grant or deny a disability. So that process can't be automatic.
Or create a death benefit by making it automatic.
Correct.
Do other plans like ours have the similar election? Is it common?
Yes. Yeah. Many deal with this all the time.
Are you talking about when you say election? You mean like this type of form?
Yes, the opportunity to pre-file a disability, act of death.
Yeah, you know, if I may, Karen highlights a very important point, and I think it goes to John's question that Candace. I'll bounce it around here. Candace's point, I believe, what I heard was. What is the quality of the evidence that is presented to us to indicate that the person was actually disabled before death? Because if we had evidence that if 2 weeks before the person died, they were disabled and off work, that's really good evidence that they were disabled, and we're comfortable with that as a board making that determination based upon medical evidence. What we're having, the question is, what's the quality of the evidence where the doctor is, where death is nearly instantaneous, there's maybe a short period of time between injury and death, or event in death, event that causes the disability, and what is the quality of the evidence that we want to have so that we're comfortable as a board, to John's point, making that determination. The board makes all kinds of medical determinations all the time, service connection and capacity. You do that all the time anyway. But, and you do it on a record of doctor's reports and the employer coming in and saying they can no longer perform the services. I mean, so you're making those kind of judgments. What I'm hearing is a discomfort with the quality of the evidence that is presented when one of these things come up. And that the board can make a determination on based upon what you hear. If you feel, Karen makes the point absolutely right, it's the applicant's burden to carry you over that doubt line and into, I feel comfortable granting this. And so you can make the determination. What you can control is what is the quality of evidence standard that you want to hear that will make you comfortable saying, yes, this person was disabled, and they didn't have time between the time they were disabled and the time they died to run in here and file an option to form. That's really what we're talking about. To Rusty's point, if you're a member, and let's just take it very simply, forget about disability. If the normal benefit is 100% to the member, and with a 60%, you know, for that person's life, with 60% continuance to the spouse, if you knew that you had a terminal illness, you wouldn't want to have the unmodified, you wouldn't want that 100% to yourself and 60 to your spouse. You'd say, oh, I, you know, in my last couple of weeks of work, I'm diagnosed with a terminal, and I know that I'm going to die 2 months into my retirement. So I'm going to elect at that time, when I have the luxury to come into Cesera and fill out a form before I retire, I'm going to elect option two, 100% continuance to my spouse, because I know I'm not going to be here. This replaces the luxury of making that judgment. This form says, I may not have the time when between the time I know I'm going to die and the time that I can come in and put that form on file. So I'm going to put the springing, if you will, form on file that says, if I find myself in that situation, I'm electing option two. And I want you to, Cesera, I want you to hold it and use the form for that purpose if I can't do it. So that's really what it's all about. It's not gaming the system or anything. It's sort of maximizing that election when you have too compressed a period of time to actually physically make that election. But the point that John and Candace are going to is, how do we know there was incapacity? How do we know that the person, you know, and that goes to the quality of the evidence that you can request, that you demand. If you think the doctor is just speculating, then the applicant hasn't carried their burden of proof on that issue. To your satisfaction, you'll take a board vote like you do on all disability issues. You'll make a determination that way. You set the standard of proof that you're comfortable with within legal parameters, of course. And then if the applicant is disappointed in that, they're going to file an appeal and you're going to go through your procedure where someone ultimately is going to make a determination whether you abused your discretion in making that judgment or it was fairly done. Does that put a little parameters around it? I don't think, John, that you can simply say we want out of the business.
But it does strike me that the applicant, in I assume most cases, is a widow. Could be a widower, I suppose, but
right.
You know, certainly grieving in the world that they just lost their spouse, perhaps having zero knowledge of how any of this stuff works, and they're the ones that are responsible for making us fully aware of the circumstances that will lead us to vote for disability. Is that a reasonable expectation? From our point of view, that they are able to do that.
Well, that's why you send it out to your own medical examiner to make a determination, because you have an obligation to the members of the system to deliver to them benefits that they are fairly qualified for, and to educate them on their options to make application for those benefits.
I guess I was thinking of the next step. We do that and we decide no. They appeal. Mm-hmm. So the appeal would presumably have to come from the widow or widower. Mm-hmm.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Okay. And they have the ability to be assisted by counsel and
okay.
to share that burden. We can't ease that burden on people, but we can do what our responsibility is to the members, which is to give them a fair opportunity to get the maximum benefit to which they're qualified, no more, no less.
And it really should be thought of as a pre-elected, if you want to call it a short form, of the disability application, because that's really what it is.
Right.
You know, it's a non-service disability application that's pre-elected because, you know, just, you know, provided what Harvey mentioned about, oh, they're in the hospital, you know, they live 2 weeks longer and then pass, they haven't had a chance to get the application and sign it and do all of that. So they're pre-electing. And so, you know, we're really reliant on our medical advisor and on the evidence that was presented. And I don't think that, you know, obviously because someone's grieving, it's like, well, you're grieving, you're not in the right frame of mind to provide this, so we're not, you know, we can't, obviously.
It just looks like the real world to me.
I know. But I think also the board needs to take that into consideration, too, because there's plenty of non-service disability applications that come through the board, and thinking about that same standard should be applying to this to these scenarios as well. So. And it is difficult because the CERL doesn't define, okay, disability has to be at least 5 minutes prior to death or,
yeah.
You know, and obviously our medical advisor has all of the information that they were operating under, and their advice is given, you know, with that. But
no, and, you know, again, just to be clear, I agree with the form. In fact, I just submitted a form today. I thought it was already on file, but anyway.
You've been looking a little peaked.
What's that?
You've been looking a little peaked.
No, but no, the reason why I brought this up is because, again, Tim had mentioned there was only 25% probably on this program, and that seemed odd, and I'm just trying to figure out if there was another program we didn't know about, or I didn't know about, that they could be using, or if, again, it's because they haven't met that 5 or 10 year threshold.
And I think that, you know, as mentioned, I think it's a number of different reasons.
Yeah,
it's like,
fine.
Well, I wouldn't qualify for that anyway, so it's one. And also, too, when they get it at the start of their employment with, you know, a stack of other forms that they're completing with their employer, you know, especially if they don't fully understand that benefit. And because it's not a universally applied, oh, this is X, Y, and Z, you know, there are those instances where it wouldn't benefit the member. So,
Well,
Karen, you mentioned that it's not a death benefit, but I recall not in our section of CERL, but there's another 1937 Act that has CERL language that actually describes a true death benefit. Is that true, I think?
There are death benefits prescribed in the CERL, which we follow, not with this process, but if someone doesn't have an active death form on file, or if their non-service connected disability is denied, for example, then we follow the death benefit section.
Okay.
It's actually described on the back side of Form 304.
That's
but
right.
I recall language, and it's been about a month and a half since I read through this, but
it's accumulated contributions plus a lump sum.
There was
payment.
Something, but there was some sub. There's a what are they divisions? The different essentially sections.
Yeah.
Thing,
yeah.
That describe for a specific 37 Act for a county that actually described actually a true death benefit that was listed as death benefit in CERL.
There are some that are particular to different
certain
counties,
yeah.
But the general ones we follow.
Yeah.
As Tim mentioned, the second enclosure to the memo in the agenda packet is Form 104, and on the back side there is a description of the death benefits that are in CERL that CICERA uses.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And then my only second point is that, to Harvey's point regarding, it seems that the question, quality of evidence is kind of what's at question here. I would actually add that it's also a question of time as well, I think, for the board members, because I think there's a question of how long is somebody disabled, because the doctor and myself, I believe, would agree that somebody that does go into cardiac arrest, there's a declination of tissue and infarction and death of the tissue over a certain duration of minutes or hours or days, depending on the patient. So,
Well, and I would just say, I think Gail made it very clear, too, is we should be applying the same standard as we should for any disability retirement. And correct. So, and then to Harvey's point, it's the quality of the evidence. And I think we were just presented with a very unique situation, although if you were shot tomorrow, and don't do it, Rusty. It'll make it so difficult for us to figure out whether or not you were alive when the bullet entered your brain. You know,
mostly because the list of suspects is so long.
No, but it is. I mean, again, I think it was a unique experience, or a unique set of circumstances when I felt like I didn't have the sufficient evidence to deem this person disabled before they died because they were actively working and they were found dead. And so that was the challenge for me. And so I doubt we'll have that many coming forward. And, you know, it sounds, I was concerned that you were going to bring us a list of, you know, 60 people a year or something, just
epidemic.
In essence, every person who dies while employed was claiming this benefit, which to me then would have a very different color on it than it being truly a disability benefit. So for me, this is helpful, and I think what we have in place works, and it's just how we as a board end up applying it.
Right. You'd sort of ask Karen, Harvey, is there additional language that either of you think makes sense in terms of allowing the board to have a more robust series of standards to make the judgment on disability in these very unique cases? Or do we have adequate amounts of language now in our guidelines?
In terms of the form itself and the disability hearing policy and what it sets forth, I think we're covered. I don't know that there's anything that needs to change. There is a section in the policy that talks about filing an application and the kind of proof that CSERA needs to accept the application. And that requires medical reports. Let me find that and point you to it. It is on page 5 of the disability hearing policy under section 2.1, making application for disability retirement. And it says that the application is filed with CSERA. There's a list of items that are supposed to be provided to CSERA for CSERA to be able to accept the application. That's before the file gets sent to the outside medical advisor for analysis. That's 2.1. And on page 6 at the top, section 2.4, this talks about the review of the application, going out to the outside medical advisor, having them review the medical file and provide a summary and a recommendation for the board. And if the medical advisor can't recommend granting the application based on the evidence submitted, CSERA advises the applicant that she or he may submit additional medical or other evidence or request a hearing before a hearing officer within 6 months. So this is kind of the process that we have. I don't know that I would change anything. I think the concerns about the quality of the evidence have been heard. I don't know that I would change anything.
You know, we might, you know, there's another section called burden of proof in the procedures, section 1.10 on page 4. I tried in the last one that came up in January, the Mozzetti matter, to give the board something that related to what it should find. And I think in that, in my letter of January, I suggested that two things were required. One, that there be a discernible period of between the event of incapacity and death. And second, that it be supported by competent medical evidence. We might, if that was, if those were satisfactory prongs of what the board would want to find in connection with this act of death disability process, we could craft something in the burden of proof section of our procedures that calls that out. So that people are put on notice, and not that it's a heightened standard, but that specifically with regard to the act of death applications, that the board will be looking for a discernible period of time between the event of incapacity and the death, and that the board's decision will be based upon competent medical evidence of that fact.
I personally say I like that.
And I would say the competent medical evidence is already in the law. Mm-hmm. The discernible period of time, we do say even on the form that this only really addresses situations where there's a disability leading to death. That to me implies that there has to be a finding of disability prior to death. So I don't know that we need to change any of the wording in the policy or have any additional wording in the form. I think it's just a matter of processing, getting these to the board and making a decision. I think the board could direct staff to have a more robust, require a more robust evidence, evidentiary reports.
Karen, we were talking about microseconds in the last case that we opined on.
Seconds to minutes, I believe, was said.
Yeah, without quibbling too much, it was a discernible period. I just had a great problem with that.
Yeah.
If this, I like the discernible, if that's doable, I mean, personally, mm-hmm. I like that as a standard, that at least gives us something tangible to make a judgment, and an applicant to have something tangible to make a judgment on this.
I believe the doctor's report said seconds
to minutes.
The events lasted minutes. The doctor said, quote, the only indication of the duration of his terminal illness is that the event lasted minutes. Therefore, in all medical probability, it caused a period of noticeable incapacitation for at least minutes prior to death. That's what the doctor said.
That to me is more specific and fuller than stating that there was a discernible period of time between disability and death.
A period of noticeable incapacitation for at least minutes prior to death.
I just, these are so in few and far between. I mean, we're seeing three a year. It's what the statistics show over the last 10 years.
Yes.
And we're backing this with medical evidence. I feel like we're splitting hairs here. Because if you say now, what's the time limit, right? Then I'm going to pose the question of, can you define death for me? And I know that sounds silly, but death is actually defined as, in some cases, of not breathing, with your heart not beating or not having a pulse. But you know,
or brain activity, depending upon.
Well, yeah, that's my point. Is now which what time are you going to go to brain death? Are you going to go to cardiac death? Or you know, because I've seen firsthand people drop in front of me and go into cardiac arrest, and clinically they're dead. They're not breathing. Their heart's not beating. But then 45 minutes later, they're sitting up in the hospital. So what do we want to? I mean, I feel like we're just splitting hairs, and this becomes a philosophical question of, you know, I think that if the doctors opine that, yeah, there's an incapacity there and somebody's disabled, and the quality of evidence, in my opinion, I think that anybody that's dead is disabled.
Well, they are, and that's the problem.
but if somebody opines that
that the, like the doctor says in that letter that counsel just read, that there's somebody's disabled, you know, for a certain number of minutes or a certain number of seconds or whatever else. I mean, so now it comes back to my first point, which was that it's a question of time for the board, because we're saying, okay, if somebody has a terminal disease and has elected this form over the duration of 2 weeks and have a terminal disease and they're expecting to die, they file this form. Well, I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, now we're saying, okay, if you do it 2 weeks in advance, you're fine. But if a doctor says you're disabled minutes before brain death, or which, you know, it's, again, it's three a year, and it's like, I think we need to make the judgment as a board, you know, and vote, like Harvey said. I just, this whole time thing, I think that's going to put us down a path of now somebody appealing and us going into court. You know, I think we should just leave it as is and just make our judgment when each one's presented before us. That's
the, the splitting hair situation is exactly why there's a hearing process in place. There's a lot of disability matters that have that are splitting hairs kind of situation on different aspects, and that is why we have the hearing process. And the burden of proof is on the person claiming the benefit to come up with enough evidence to persuade, first of all, an administrative law judge, and then the board, that they've carried their burden of proof.
And I would just add, in that situation, and this is why I'm saying it is going to be a case by case, and it's an evidentiary burden that needs to be met. The doctor's comments were conclusory. They didn't provide what he was basing it upon. Like, I saw claw marks leading toward the door where clearly he was alive, or, I mean, something else. You know, I can have you two say, well, geez, we're medical professionals, we're telling you, but you're not the doctors. I'm not relying on your expertise. He's a doctor.
But he's not
yeah, you're a paramedic. Yeah. No, but I'm not relying on your opinions.
No,
I want the doctor to say, based upon these factors, we determined that he was alive for at least 5 minutes, and he was therefore incapacitated, and it could be, you know, much more detailed information than what we had before us. And hopefully we're not going to have, you know, the gunshot and not you, Rusty. Just, you know, we're not going to have that instantaneous death situation. You're the one who brought it up, first of all. You said if I'm shot, and okay, so that's why I brought it up. But, no, hopefully we're not going to have that instantaneous death one, because I don't want to get into that nanosecond. This one was close enough, and I think we really... just what you can do as staff is make sure, if we have one of these, we just have a very thorough analysis that shows that this person was disabled and did not instantly die, because there is that distinction. I want to use the same disability standard on this that I use on the person who works for the court, who comes up and says, I'm unable to work anymore, and therefore I want my disability retirement. And we say, sure you can. You can still do A, B, and C. So I just want us to have a consistent standard.
David?
There's a different standard for safety versus non-safety. And so you kind of give the safety member the benefit of the doubt. They had an ankle injury, and then they can no longer perform the duties of police officer or whatever. In all practicality, I think of this situation that, with the challenge of this being that this was an unwitnessed death, that you have to just give the benefit of the doubt to the individual. I think that's the only thing you can really do. And the medical expert felt confident that an individual having a heart attack would experience the symptoms for several minutes before succumbing is a very reasonable. You can only work with the information that you have, and what is it that typically happens to somebody when they go through such an event? Just because it wasn't witnessed doesn't mean that you can say, well, it wasn't witnessed. We don't have all the information, therefore we can't grant this. I think you just have to give the individual.
But it would be incumbent upon the doctor writing the report to put that detailed level of information in his report so that a layperson, which is the rest of us on the board, would be able to say, okay, these are the factors that he relied upon in reaching that conclusion. In this report, we didn't have it. In the Central Sand report, we didn't have that level of information, even though we all approved. He died, he was disabled. So that's all I'm asking for, David. You know, I'm not saying if we had the identical situation, I would just expect a different type of report.
So what do you, do you want him to go into more detail about what physiologically happens?
I want him to go on the basis of his opinion. What information, what expertise, what analysis of the deceased or of the medical records led him to believe that the person was alive for a discernible period of time and therefore disabled during that period of time. So again, it's just, each one is going to be a different case-by-case analysis.
But that could take a very in-depth forensic level of evaluation, and I don't know if you really have to go there. I think
we may not. And again, we've already decided the other case, so this is just moving forward. The level of evidence I'd like to see.
And what I'm hearing is just providing the basis for making that determination.
Yeah.
And if possible, flesh that out a little more. Yeah. And obviously, on a case-by-case basis, that's going to vary what that's going to look like.
Absolutely.
On a side note, one of the things that when we discussed this previously was relating to the funding of this benefit. And, you know, we mentioned at that time that it is currently taken into consideration by the actuaries. And, you know, I just wanted to reiterate, you know, this is a non-service connected disability benefit. And that's where that falls into that bucket when we talk about the valuation mm-hmm. report and the assumptions. There isn't anything specific in the experience of these small numbers that you can see that would make us want to carve that out and have a different assumption or anything like that. It really is going into that non-service connected disability bucket when it comes to relating to the valuation and whether or not that's a funded benefit, because it is. So I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you,
Kate. I very much appreciated the opportunity to go through this again. I am satisfied with what we have today. Mm-hmm. And I think in the last case, and not to make it a personal instance, but we did go back and ask for someone else's opinion on the basis of the documentation that was available to him, not because he was there, not because he witnessed it, not because it was that physician's treated patient, but we asked for another opinion, and basically we got an opinion as to what probably led up to this. The danger for me would be to try and have some hard and fast rule that says, has to be 90 seconds, has to be more than 3 minutes. If it's less than 30 seconds, it doesn't qualify. I think when you start to slice and dice the bologna that thin, then you're asking for judgments that we can't make. And I think they strike me as totally arbitrary. So I'm satisfied with the responsibility we have, mm-hmm. which we exercise on a regular basis in different sets of circumstances, and I see no reason why we can't continue to exercise that responsibility now or going forward. Jay?
I have a real discomfort with thinking about the opposite case where I don't know how we would decide that someone didn't qualify for this benefit, but I'm fine with the idea of taking a medical expert's opinion in that. Mm-hmm. The other scenario in which I would feel particularly miserable is if an employee died while working but didn't have this form on file for some reason, if they were part of the 80% or so that we mentioned at the beginning. Because they weren't acting rationally, or they were unclear about, what benefits were due to them. So I'd just ask that we make some kind of effort to remedy that.
Yeah,
if we're going to have this situation, then everyone should have access to it.
Maybe on their 5th or 10th anniversary, send them a personal letter. I don't know, but something to again inform them to make sure that their opportunity is now. Don't miss out on it.
Yeah, and I think that, as we've taken a look at the information and seen kind of the response rate of the form and that kind of thing, we are going to look at member communications and see, because I think this form on a standalone basis needs a cover sheet or something on there if we're going to be doing a mailing or something like that so that they can. Because it's really inherent on us to educate our membership on the benefits that you know, that are owed and due to them that they pay into. So, you know, it's something, you know, whether it's in the, you know, you mentioned the annual statement, you know, kind of taking a look at, okay, what's the best, more most effective way of getting that information to the member. And that's something that we'll take a look at.
Well, and I would say it's probably through our HR departments because they're the ones that are having the employees sign the forms.
Yeah.
And so as HR departments turn over, they may not, you know, to me it would be very easy to just send out a memo with the form to HR, all of our members' HR departments, and just say, you know, are you aware that your employees, you know, you're probably aware, but we want to make sure you have them track the anniversaries, or have them, as new employees come in, sign the form, assuming they'll be there for 5 or 10 years, because they're the ones who have the direct contact.
And also, as we started last year, we started doing the employer visits where we're having info sessions. This year, we're going to have info sessions with, you know, active members coming to our location, and that's one thing that can definitely be included as part of that education session for them.
So this is... this form is not tracked in the CPAS right now, currently?
As far as who we have it for and who we don't, it's not.
No. So, and these letters you generate each year for each member, is that generated out of CPAS, or how is that put together?
Which letters?
The ones where you...
The annual statement.
The annual statements. The data is derived from our system.
CPAS?
Yeah.
I was just wondering, again, kind of like what we do on tax bills, we'll let them know through an indicator or some one-liner that you're enrolled or you're not enrolled in.
Yeah, it's not a field that we have historically tracked in either the legacy system or CPAS. As we go forward with a new system, one of the benefits of that, which was, you know, you voted on earlier, is a workflow system so that, okay, you see the check boxes, you can do queries and reporting on different things and, you know.
Okay.
Much more easier to see what's in our database than being kept.
Todd's idea about putting some info with the annual statement, I think, is
it's a natural.
It gets to everybody.
But do they read it
when we get there?
Well, at some point, you
lead a horse.
You have to let go of their hand, right?
Well, I know, but I mean, if it was a personal letter as opposed to a general letter,
gotcha.
They're more likely to read all of it.
Yeah, because also what we've some years we put the PAFR, the popular annual financial report, in with the member statement to reduce the mailing cost as well. So it's also thinking about how many documents do we want to send in one blast.
I know postage can be expensive.
I think we just need to take a look at it and kind of determine what's going to be most effective in communicating to the member.
But yeah, to clarify, on CPAS, they are marking, and they started in the last couple of years, they are marking that a document. That document does come in the document section, but a copy of it is retained in our imaging system. It is also goes out at least in one newsletter a year as you know, benefit and get the form in, as well as when they hold those employer meetings to go through our benefits, it's included in the employer meetings also.
It's so getting documented, but it's not something that's easy for us to pull.
Oh, it's not. There's no field you can just include in your drawdown, I guess, whatever the term is for it, to populate your letter, your statement. Okay. It's just an idea.
But as we look for the next system, some of these things will get incorporated with that.
Yeah, and some of these forms, I mean, we will have, I'm not sure if the form will come up with the board or not. I mean, we have a form that came in on, I'm going to say, a recent death, and it's from the forms. They used the forms that were available at that time to accomplish the active death. It's from 1989, and it's more of putting two different forms together and providing them to us, but that was the active death process at that time. So there is a lot of, you know, unique and different variations also out there.
Any further discussion on this item? All right. I think that was a really good talk. Thanks, everyone.